From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Technology has always played a key role in entertainment. From the design of a primitive drum to the most complex sound system imaginable, humans have gone to great lengths to entertain themselves as well as to express themselves creatively. Artis Wodehouse is a pianist and a music scholar. The National Endowment for the Humanities initially funded her study of the early player piano roles of George Gershwin. She'll tell us about the fascinating process of converting these roles to the technology of today. I'll also speak with Jeff Leibowitz. Jeff is the director of marketing for the Imagination Network. His company offers very unusual services as far as networks go. From multiplayer adventure games to high-tech casinos and personal challenges, we'll hear about this new form of entertainment that simply would not be possible without technology. Artis Wodehouse is a pianist whose work in studying early player piano roles has led to the unexpected hit CD, Gershwin Plays Gershwin. I asked her how it was possible that some 60 years after his death, Gershwin could play Gershwin.
Gershwin did make piano rolls, and they were an idiom unto themselves. There were ways of actually capturing the hand playing of an artist in the piano roll technology by attaching little rods basically to the key bed, and it would inscribe on a moving piece of paper underneath the artist as they play the piano. But piano rolls could also be edited. You could add more notes to the paper rolls, and so you could create a more rich and exciting texture than one person could lay down by hand. So it was not only a way of capturing live performance, but also it was a compositional medium as well.
You know, that's not unlike what we see today with the technology. First, a musician will play into a keyboard, and then they bring it up on their screen.
Absolutely. I mean, there are direct analogies today in many, many ways, in more ways than I had even thought when we started.
Now, let's go back to this sort of golden age of the player piano. And this is a really fond memory for me. When I was a kid, my grandmother used to go up to an old farmhouse up in New York, right, upstate New York, mm-hmm, and they had been taking in boarders since who knows when. And in the 20s, I guess, the late teens and the 20s, right, they had these player pianos. And as a kid, I would go up there, and here was these old rolls, mm-hmm, many of which were Gershwin. I called my mother.
Yes, really? You did? You've got Gershwin rolls?
Gershwin. Well, I don't have them, but I used to play them. And the most popular ones didn't have the starter set up because they'd been used. And
oh, you mean the roll leader? Yes, of
the
course.
The roll leader.
Ripped.
Right. And I remember that there were holes in all the paper coming in. And as they went by, they would also have the words to the song.
Yes, they would.
Buffalo Gals, Can You Come Out Tonight, leaps to mind. Were these just notes that were on there? Is that all there was?
Well, the holes in the rolls triggered the keys to play, and it was used, the energy source was actually a bellows. It was all by air-driven energy, and there was pneumatic tubing and a quite complex mechanism, actually, for its day. And when the holes went over the tracker bar, it opened up the suction, and it caused the notes to trigger.
Ah, so what we're talking about is all the keys on the piano would be attached to one of these
through
holes.
Tubing, yes, that's right, and had its own pneumatic pouch. And
so when that was originally created, the first one, the prototype, someone could play and it would punch the holes through.
Well, the reverse process was you would sit at a piano and there were little, there was a connector between the key bed as the note would go down and some instrument that would inscribe on a moving piece of paper the note on, note off, actually. And then that paper, which had the little inscriptions of the events of the artist as they played the piano, they made perforations in the inscription, and they had a rough roll to start working with. And that's how that was the original way it was made. But let me just stress that was one way that piano rolls were made. There were other ways. You could just directly cut note perforations into a piece of paper if you knew what you were doing, and you could create a piano roll without recourse to hand playing.
So if you knew what you were doing,
you could just do it just mechanically.
So Gershwin was taking many of his own compositions then. and starting with them as a base.
Well, actually, he didn't, because Gershwin's piano rolls were made when he was a young man, between 1915 and 1925, 26, and he was born 1898. And at that time, he was not famous for his compositions because he hadn't written them yet. So most of his piano rolls were of tunes of other composers. It was only toward 1920 that his own compositions came to the fore, and it's really a pity that Moore did not get on roll.
So tell us about the body of work that represents the piano rolls. How many were there from George Gershwin, and what are they made of?
Yeah, Gershwin recorded approximately 130 piano rolls, of which I think 18 or 20 are of his own tunes. The rest are by other composers, because that's what Gershwin was doing during that early period of his life. He was playing the music of others as a song plugger and as a rehearsal pianist and as an accompanist to singers and dancers on vaudeville.
Ultimately, now, these piano rolls have made their way into a CD.
Correct.
Now, tell us the process that you took starting.
Well, of course, what I wanted to do as a scholar was to find the so-called authentic way of performing these roles, and I auditioned many player pianos across the country looking for the ideal instruments, and as any fool could tell you, there's no such thing as authentic. They're authentics. There are many different ways that could have been possible during that time, ranging from very poor renditions where there was no dynamics added, and that's authentic, too. So, in other words, I found out that there was no one correct way to do it. So, and the other thing that I found out was that the disrepair of many of these instruments across the country was very severe. And even with the ones that were in fine condition, for us to fine-tune them and to bring them into the recording place that we had set out in New York was almost prohibitive because of the danger to the instruments and because of the vagaries of the adjustments. Really, that was it. So at that time, this whole new range of technologies became available, and I mean literally, as I was going around the country, these things were evolving, unbeknownst to me, actually, in many respects. And when I finally did find out that there are ways of taking the original rolls and converting them to a floppy disk format where we could actually have them played back as they had been played back originally, and in some cases, of course, we could enhance them and therefore create a fine product for the recording when we would actually sit down and play the things for the microphone. That was so appealing to have that kind of artistic control that I decided this was the way we should go.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Artis Wodehouse, a Gershwin scholar. She's received a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to study the player piano rolls of George Gershwin. You started with some player pianos, and you started with some piano rolls.
Right.
How did you move to the newer technology?
Well, piano rolls are just information, just like any other medium. It shows you when the notes turn on and when they turn off in time. And then, in certain cases, the reproducing rolls, it triggers the note velocity. In other words, how fast the hammer travels to the string. And that determines the loudness or softness of the note. The faster a hammer goes to the string, the louder it's going to be. And so that was all the information that was on the rolls.
Now, how did it say how fast it went?
Well, they developed a coding that was also triggered by pneumatics that tripped the hammer to travel at a certain speed. And, I mean, it was very ingenious. It was a binary coding system. It apparently has only ostensibly 16 levels, but actually it has many, many more intermediary levels than that. And another factor that you had to figure into the coding if you were coding the rolls was how many notes were being sounded at once, because, of course, it would bleed off the energy source real fast if you had a lot of notes simultaneously sounding than if you had only two or three. So at the same level, say level five, if three notes were sounding, they'd be much louder than 15 notes sounding at level five.
You know, it is interesting, and it's not hard to conceive that if the square that was open, that the air was coming through, was small, yeah, it would be higher pressure. And so
yes,
the hammer would travel faster.
That's right.
And if it was wider, there would be lesser pressure.
Well, actually, those holes were more or less standardized. Certainly the tracker bars were at that time. Uh-huh. So there was a certain amount of standardization that occurred around, I guess it was about 1908 or 9, I'm not quite sure, where it was like IBM and Apple sort of merged. So by the time Gershwin was making piano rolls, there was a lot of standardization.
So how did you get the information off the piano rolls?
Well, part of the problem or part of the challenge of this was that Gershwin made several types of rolls, but they fell into two different categories. The first were what called the 88-note rolls, and these were simply rolls that had the information about the notes and the rhythms. The note came on and the note came off at a certain point in time. There was no dynamic assigned to the notes. In other words, the loud and the soft, the makes interpretation, that makes the humanity of any performance was not there on the roll. So what we did was, well, what I did was I purchased a pianola push-up, which was a predecessor of the player piano. It's a machine. It was built in 1911, and it was being manufactured during the time Gershwin was making piano rolls, but it was then not the way that it was done in most homes. But what a pianola push-up does is that it's a big sort of coffin-like affair that rolls up to any standard piano and has 88 fingers that are made of metal and they are felt-tipped. And you insert your piano roll right in the center and you sit in front of the pianola, which is sitting in front of the piano. So you're sitting in front, sitting in front, and there's the piano. And you foot pump just like what the player piano does. It works on the same identical principle as the player piano. It's all pneumatics and bellows. And the fingers play. And they play the roll, and they play it into a piano.
Oh, right on top of
on top of the keys. You know, it's a really neat instrument, but very bulky, difficult to get adjusted right over the keys. And you can see, you know, it weighs about 200 pounds. You can see why it was superseded by the interplaying player piano, because the companies realized around, you know, 1900 that this was just not going to do, and they could sell more pianos anyway by installing that mechanical apparatus inside of a piano rather than having it sitting outside. So but luckily they did make something like this for our purposes, because we were able to roll that instrument, the pianola push-up, in front of a disc clavier. Now, the disc clavier is a regular acoustic piano manufactured by Yamaha that's been fitted with a computer. And this computer can record your own hand playing. In other words, if you sat down and played your own tune and pressed the record button, it would play back just as you played. And it can also accept data from other instruments or, you know, from other disc claviers or what have you, music that was actually manufactured quite mechanically inside computers, and it will play back also. So what the disc clavier does is it records and can play back. And so it's a kind of an updated player piano, but that record function, it makes it more desirable than the old player pianos, which could only play back from piano rolls. So what we did was we rolled the pianola up to this disc clavier, and the fingers centered over the keys. We recorded the roll, me foot pumping the roll, and you press the playback button, and voila, you have the roll recording. And that's how we did those 88-note rolls. Now, the pianola push-up also, in addition to being able to play back the rolls, you can add dynamics. You can add loud and soft. You can add pedaling. You can add accents. And this is what I did. Playing the pianola, I followed the dynamic line that was printed on the original roll. But of course, I added many of my own ideas, because the dynamic line was very rudimentary, and certainly Gershwin would have never played that way. So I was able to add interactively. It was a very interactive medium. In fact, the whole player piano era, most player pianos were this type. In other words, you sat down there, you foot pumped, and by your foot pumping skill and using the little levers and knobs that were always on the player piano, you could develop your own interpretation. And that was part of the aesthetic of that period.
So it's artists playing Gershwin, playing Gershwin.
Well, yeah, and I think one of the things that I'm running up against is people are saying, well, it's not Gershwin, but no way, unless I was an idiot savant being inspired by Gershwin, could I ever play like Gershwin, and nobody can do exactly as Gershwin living today. And even Gershwin, when he played always the same piece different ways. So there's no, again, coming back to standardization. This is performance, ladies and gentlemen. This is not something cast in granite out in the desert. And the thing that does give me, I hope, some credibility is that I actually transcribed Gershwin's disc recording, his 78 disc recordings, which he made in 1926 and 28 for Columbia, where I sat there for thousands of hours and listened to Gershwin. So ostensibly, I should know something about the Gershwin style, and I'm not promoting myself as such, but that was one of the reasons they asked me to do the project.
Well, a lot of times in technology and in science, people say, well, you can't do it perfectly, so it's not any good. And it's like, hey, you're 90% of the way there, 95% of the way there, if you have that base information. And then moving it ahead, it's like, well, it's better than nothing.
Well, I think that there will never be 100%. We will never even know what percent is right, because there's no way to tell how Gershwin would have played some of these earlier roles.
The information's gone.
It's gone. It's just gone. So what? They are like scores. Gershwin wrote An American in Paris. We don't really know how he would have performed it, because there are no recordings of him conducting an orchestra. There's no recording of him conducting the Cuban Overture. There are just little dribs and drabs of some of the other things. So we don't really know. We can never know how he wanted these things. And moreover, if he wanted them a certain way, he would have changed his mind from time to time. That's part of performance. It's a plastic, evolving art.
Well, we have a disc clavier here today. Artist, can you play something for us?
Yeah, I'd like to start with Swanee. This was Gershwin's role of 1920. It was his first hit tune that sold 1 million copies.
Gosh, as I look at it play, it looks like Gershwin must have had 15 hands.
Well, this is actually not true for this selection. I chose this selection because, first of all, it's loud. It's very exciting. But also, it's as Gershwin would actually hand play. He had a very thick, very full, very orchestral hand-played style. And I could sit down and hand play this selection identically to Gershwin, because I've created scores from this material. The Swanee role is pretty much based in his hand playing. That's the way he hand played. And if you hear a 78 disc, you'll hear the same very full, very thick style.
So you say you can play this directly.
Well, I hope so, but I haven't been practicing recently because I've been working on the publicity for this project. But yeah, I'll try it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, that was great.
Well, it's not as good as Gershwin, but it gives you the idea of what it was like to actually, how he actually played.
It's almost like he was here.
Yeah.
Another thing that amazes me is that I think some people may not have heard of a Yamaha discclavier. This is not an unusual instrument that was created just for this research. I realized that Yamaha, first of all, many people don't know this, is the largest manufacturer of grand pianos today. And the discclaviers represents 8% of all the pianos sold worldwide. It's an amazing instrument. So it says to me that there's a lot of these out there, almost like the player piano of today. Can I get a floppy disk with this on it?
Well, yes, I think we will be having it coming out pretty soon. I think probably March this month for discclavier owners.
Right. Now, your editing of these pieces, did you do them on the pianola push-up or did you do them on the Yamaha?
Well, the pianola push-up was sort of our base source for how I wanted the interpretation to go, but because we had the blandishment of being able to edit them a little bit more to make them more refined artistically, you know, you can take the data, put it in a computer, and you can move the notes around, you can adjust some note velocities so that it's more musically apt. And we did definitely do some of that with the ones that I pianolized. But I should mention that there's a second type of roll that Gershwin made, which had those automatic dynamics coded on the side. So I didn't play those on the pianola. They were read by Richard Tonneson's roll reader. And then Richard Brandel, both of these guys live in Texas, created a program that took the information stored in Richard Tonneson's computer and basically converted the information on the roll to a format that could be accepted by the
floppy disk on the Yamaha.
Yes, that's right. And so it was basically, he created a simulator. You know, Richard Brandel created a simulator of what the old DuoArt reproducing mechanism could do. And one of the advantages of this was that, you know, if we had used an original DuoArt player, because they're made of leather and wood and felt, they are subject to a lot of vagaries from the climate, you know, from
age and humidity.
There's so many
things. Yeah.
So when we did our computer conversion, anytime it was level 6 with 5 notes sounding with this theming being in a certain position, it was always going to come out that way. And rather than hitting a moving target, it was going to be hit always on the target.
So they optically scanned, I would assume.
Actually, no, it was a pneumatic scanner he used, but it was he used an old reproducing piano or player piano tracker bar, ran the roll over very slowly, and electrodes were connected to each one of the holes that, as it read, it went across the hole. It was attached into his computer, and he created a visual image of the roll in his computer that looks like the roll. And it was Brandel who took that visual image and created the program.
What an act of preservation all this is.
Yeah. The reason Tonneson created this roll reader was to store information for rolls that he recuts. He has a recutting operation called Custom Music Rolls, and that's where it started. And then Brandel realized if it was stored in the computer, he could create a program to read the dynamics for the reproducing rolls.
So we know once you have the digital data, it doesn't deteriorate.
No. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Artis Wodehouse. She's a pianist and a music scholar who's used technology to bring George Gershwin's own performance, as reflected in early piano rolls, to a CD. Gershwin Plays Gershwin has topped the Billboard charts. When you were doing all this work, did you have any idea that when you went to CD that it would be this popular?
Not at all. I was just hoping we'd cover costs. That was it, really.
How popular is it?
Well, I know it's it has been on number one, number two, number three, and classical. There are different categories of classical. It passed over into the pop charts. I don't know just where it stands right now, but I should say it's certainly sold over 100,000 copies, which is remarkable for a classical record.
How did you decide what to put on the CD?
Well, we recorded 65 of Gershwin's rolls. I forced them to do this. I would say I forced them. They wanted to do that. But of those, we chose 12 for the first release that were Gershwin playing his own tunes. Plus, we put An American in Paris on, which is not Gershwin's roll, but was made by his roll editor. So there's an historic link to Gershwin anyway. We wanted to put these ones to really show what he did that was his own materials. But believe me, the stuff that we haven't released is just fabulous as well. There's still some more of his own tunes to come, and many, many, many others of composers who are his contemporaries that he made these unique piano arrangements, piano roll arrangements.
So we're going to see more CDs.
Yes, at least two more.
Were there any differences, you know, from the ones they used the push-up for versus the other technology?
Yes, there were significant differences. And with the roles that I use the pianola for, I think they have more of the vagary of human performance because they're not rhythmically as accurate as the ones that are the automatically coded, because I had to constantly ride the tempo lever, because when you would make a louder sound, it would make the governor move a little faster, move the roll ahead a little faster. It was never a perfect governor. So I always had to pull the tempo back to adjust to this. And so there's a little bit of shifting around in the rhythm. The duo arts, the ones that had the reproducing dynamics in them that were automatic, they were what you call quantized. The beats, the distances between the beats and the measure were identical. They were like metronomic. Now, the editors got around that by slightly delaying and advancing note attacks. But nevertheless, underlying is a metronomic beat. Now, that was a necessity in many cases for the instrument to realize optimally. But that was the style that they did for the dance roles, the up-tempo pieces that were the reproducing pieces. They definitely quantized beats. Actually, the 88-note rolls were also, most of them were quantized as well. But just because you're interactively using this Rube Goldberg affair, the pianola, it's never as precise. But on the other hand, it gives you the chance to be more fluid rhythmically. So it was both a blessing and a curse. And so I wanted to play Idle Dreams, which is one of those that I pianolized. That is a rhythmic piece, but has a little bit the flux of human performance.
Okay. Now, I am a Gershwin fan, and I'm going to name some tunes. Name that tune. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can tell me if they're on the piano rolls. I have to say, now I'm going to give myself away as a real romantic here. So when yes. You hear this one, how about A Foggy Day in London Town?
No, was a 30s piece. By that time, he had stopped making piano rolls long since.
These are probably all 30s plays.
Well, let's hear your list.
All right. Our Love Is Here to Stay.
Forget it. No.
Someday He'll Come Along. The Man I Love.
The Man I Love, no.
Someone to Watch Over Me. You like that?
No.
None of these.
Yeah, it's interesting. The ones that are on the disc that was just released are the most famous ones. And they were Sweet and Low Down, That Certain Feeling.
An American in Paris.
American in Paris and Rhapsody in Blue. I think those are the top famous ones. The other ones are Scandal Walk, you never heard of it, Idle Dreams. But Idle Dreams is charming. Swanee's on.
Swanee.
Obviously, we just played that.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a big question as to why Gershwin didn't make more roles of his own materials, and it's just too bad he didn't.
Artist, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest today has been Artis Wodehouse, a music scholar. Her first CD, Gershwin Plays Gershwin, The Piano Rolls, is available from Elektra. We'd also like to thank the Gary Leuenberger Company in San Francisco for providing the Yamaha Disc Lavier Piano, which you hear throughout this program. Could you play us one more?
I'd like to play one of the duo art, the reproducing numbers that were the quantized beats, but it's a wonderful example of a duo art roll.
Terrific. Thank you. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Networks and bulletin boards are commonplace to us now. We have the Internet, CompuServe, and America Online, to name a few. And then there is the Imagination Network. Jeff Leibowitz is Director of Marketing for Imagination. This network has less to do with information and a lot more to do with entertainment and socialization. I asked him how it was different.
The Imagination Network is an online game-playing network where people with personal computers can sign on over their normal telephone and telephone line to a world of thousands of other people, night and day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that are playing games. But games, as it turns out, is actually just an excuse. The actual value of the network is socialization. People talking with and playing games against other real-life people that are calling in from all over the country.
Well, I think that's one really important distinction. Most people think you log in or you call in or however you access it, however you want to call that, and you're playing against the computer. You're just getting a game. But no, you're finding other people.
That's right. There are a few games that we allow you to play against the computer, but by and large, you play games against other real-life people that have also called in with their PCs, and you may be in New York and they may be in Minneapolis or California, and you'll be playing a game against one or three or four or however many other people, depending on the game. And they could be all over the country and probably are.
Now, truckers with CB radios have handles, and people on the Internet have email addresses like moira@radio.com. But people on the Imagination Network have personas?
We have a cartoon-like persona, somewhat akin to the police kit where you take certain noses and you put them on your face and certain eyes and certain mouths and certain hair and clothes and so on. And you assemble a cartoon-like image of what you are or what you claim you are. And about 50% of the people on the network role play. They aren't
exactly lying.
Who they say they are. Well, it's not lying, it's acting.
I see.
There's a subtle but definite difference. It's actually quite hard to do that kind of thing on the network, and you can usually ferret out the people that are real and the people that are role playing.
Uh-huh.
But you have a tune or a persona, and in it you can define your interest levels in games, your hobbies, your name, perhaps where you're located in the country. You can put your age. All of this is optional. You do have what others would call a handle, because you can assign yourself virtually any name, but everything else is purely optional, and you can make up whomever you want to be.
Now, do these personas, do they play a role in any of the games?
The personas, not really, with the minor exception of when you're playing things like 3D golf. If you have a male persona, you get a full-figured male character playing golf, or a female persona, you get a full-figured female character. Of course, that has a different connotation there, but nonetheless, you have a tie-in, in essence. The personas are also different based on the lands that you're in. There are different lands within the world of imagination. There's the basic area, which is called the clubhouse, and the clubhouse has your basic board and card games like chess and backgammon and cribbage and so on and so forth. Then there's Sierra Land. Sierra Land is the arcade-style land. We thought for kids, but it turns out that more adults play in Sierra Land than kids. Then there's Medieval Land, which is a role-playing, dark and dungeon-like game, or actually two games called The Shadow of Cerberus and The Fates of Twinian. And then there's Casino Land, which is an adults-only area that is basically casino games, poker and blackjack and roulette and so on and so forth. Each of these lands has their own persona. So in Casino Land, you're a somewhat more risque adult. In Medieval Land, you're a gnome or an elf or a dwarf or a wizard or whatever you'd like to be.
Princess,
a knight.
Jeff.
We actually don't have princess, but...
How politically correct of you. I'd like to encourage
exactly
that.
Right.
There we go.
Yes, we don't want to do that. In Sierra Land, you basically have the persona of a kid. Everybody looks somewhat childish, if you will, and it's for the kid in all of us. And then in the clubhouse, you have your kind of typical adult-looking persona.
So your personas change as you move through the land?
Well, they don't change by themselves. You create different persona for each land.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about Medieval Land? What do we find in there?
That is actually the most popular area on the network. It has what most people know of as Dungeons and Dragons types of games in it, where you become some very mystical creature and you wander through the dungeons trying to solve puzzles and find treasures and battle all of the many foe that will come up against you. And there are dragons and lizards and elves and gnomes and all kinds of things down in the dungeon. So you fight your way through, you earn points, you gain gold, you buy weapons, you solve mysteries, and eventually, perhaps, you solve the riddle of the mountain because you're basically in a volcano. And it's quite an interesting story that I won't tip off. It actually takes about 100 hours to complete the puzzle. And then The Fates of Twinian, which is the next game after The Shadow of Cerberus, is even more difficult, taking some people as much as 1,000 hours to solve. So it requires a lot of dedication, and it really does get it. People are absolutely fanatical about the games.
Now, are these games available anywhere else or only on your network?
The Fates of Twinian is available as a separate boxed game, and you can play it offline. All of the other games are available only by virtue of calling up the network. And if indeed you buy The Fates of Twinian at a software, etc., or similar store, you can also get online with that same software.
Now, in Sierra Land, there are all these different, I don't know if you call them games as well, the Rocket Quiz and Graffiti. Some of these were games that I knew from just going to the toy store, like Stratego.
Well, Stratego certainly is a very popular game that's been around for many years and very popular on the network, and we'll be bringing on more and more traditional classic Milton Bradley and Hasbro types of games onto the network as time goes on. But the other games present a wide range of activities, and that's basically the primary goal, is to give as broad a sense of enjoyment as we possibly can to all the members. Graffiti is a drawing package, similar to a lot of the PC drawing packages that have been around for many years. The difference being that multiple people or multiple kids can draw on the same picture at the same time. So I can be drawing on a picture in New York, and somebody in Atlanta can be drawing on that same picture, and we end up with a group-created picture. One thing we did not think of, but our members fortunately did, was that you can use the same feature to play win, lose, or draw, or Pictionary, or games like that, and a lot of members use graffiti for that purpose.
So you can play Hangman.
That's correct. That's
correct. My kids are in danger now.
Well, actually, it's more adults that do that than kids.
Oh, really?
It's surprising.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Jeff Leibowitz. He's the Director of Marketing for the Imagination Network, generically described as a virtual community and a cyberspace theme park. What do you need to get on this network?
Basically, the standard computer that you buy in any store today, PC compatible, a 386 or better machine, you need a 2400 baud or better modem, a mouse, and obviously enough disk space to store the now 12 megabytes worth of software that we give you when you sign on. So it's a fairly basic system from the point of view of running it on your PC, but it does have a lot of games in it and therefore takes up some space.
Is it just IBM PC or PC clones? Can you also do it with a Mac?
We do not yet have a Mac version. We are, however, releasing in the not-too-distant future a version for the Sega Edge device, which is a device that you plug into your Sega CD player, and it allows you to dial up online services as well as present a keyboard and some other features. We will also be introducing a little later on, in this year or early next year, a 3DO version.
When I think about it, all the PCs that are out there, and unbelievably, all the Sega Genesis that are out there, how many people could have access to this market? Millions.
Well, it depends on who you talk to as to how many PCs are in homes. However, Intel says that approximately 45% of all the PCs that they're shipping or that are shipped with Intel chips in them are now going into homes. That's dramatically different than it was even 3 or 4 years ago. So the number of PCs in homes is increasing at an incredible rate. There are something on the order of 20 to 30 million PCs in homes today. There are something on the order of an equal number of Sega and Nintendo types of machines in homes today. So though there's some overlap, certainly, one might argue that there's perhaps 40 million homes that could be connected to online services by virtue of those two platforms.
Now, how much does all this cost the user?
The basic membership is $9.95 per month, which gives you 5 hours of access, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. There are larger packages for people that use a lot more time.
Well, what's your profile of a user?
The profile is interesting. We deal with a split demographic, and the split is those people who purchase and pay for the service versus those people who actually use the service. The people that purchase and pay for the service are males between the ages of 18 and 45. But generally speaking, males between the ages of 18 and 45 are out earning the money to pay for the purchase of the service. The people that use it turn out to be not only their kids, but their parents. We are equally popular with senior citizens as we are with teenagers. And in terms of usage time on the network, those two groups use far more than males 18 to 45. We also have probably twice, perhaps three times, the number of female users on our network in terms of percentage than any other. We're approximately 20 to 25% female right now, which is dramatically higher than any other online service.
Well, when I think of the video game market, which has some correlation, I think we're talking 95, 96% male. So this is a much higher.
It's much higher because, again, the games are not really the point. The socialization, which women are generally much more interested in and much better at, is really the kind of hallmark of the network that people are attracted to. Computer games are striving very, very strongly to go toward the female market. There's no reason logically why females should not enjoy and play computer games just as much as males. What we find is that under the age of about 7 or 8, usage of video games is absolutely equal. Between the ages of 8 and 20, usage almost disappears for females. And then after the age of 20, usage actually picks up for females, not nearly to a 50-50 level, but considerably. I think part of that is explained in a book by Dr. Deborah Tannen on male-female communication called You Just Don't Understand. And one of the points she makes in that book is that males work in a hierarchical world where somebody has to be better than the other person, somebody has to win. Whereas women tend to work, and little girls tend to play, in a world of equality where everybody should share and have fun and be equally pleased by the experience. We are trying, and the industry in general, is trying to create games that appeal to that sense, which certainly would do well for men as well if we could learn.
Well, there's actually a story behind the story here, so let me kind of direct you over here. How did all this get started?
It's actually the brainchild of Ken Williams, who is the founder and president of Sierra Online, one of our parent companies. We recently have been acquired also by AT&T and General Atlantic Partners, so we're now jointly owned by those three companies. Ken's Image was really a network that his grandmother could get on at 2 a.m. if she couldn't sleep one night and play bridge. And the criteria was that it be easy enough for his grandmother to use and that it be affordable enough because she's on a limited income. As a matter of fact, the first 100 beta testers of what was then called the Sierra Network were indeed senior citizens that had never before touched a computer. And the concept was that if they could use it and like it, anybody could. And that approach seemed to work very, very well. And we are still to this day very popular with senior citizens.
I know many senior citizens who've gotten on any of these networks, and it really has made a real difference in their lives.
It's made a difference in a lot of people's lives, especially the 12 people that are now married as a result of having met on the network. And there are far more arrangements, shall we say, of people that have met and dated and just made friends on the network.
Well, how do they do that? They're not just coming on to play games. And how do you, well, first of all, how do you hook up with somebody to play a game?
When you go into the land of imagination, you find yourself at a map that kind of looks like a New England town. And there's the town hall where you do your administrative things, and there's a post office where you do your email, and a schoolhouse for educational games, and then the lands that we discussed earlier. When you go into a land, you end up in what we call a waiting room, and there are many different waiting rooms in every land. The waiting rooms kind of imply what you might want to do there, though you can do anything in any room. For example, one room is called the chess and go room, so you might want to play chess and go there. One room is called the singles club, and there's also the singles place, and the singles this, and the singles that. Singles is a very, very popular area. Then, of course, we got complaints from the married people who said, hey, if the singles people have a place to go, we want a place to go. So there's the married club, and you can go in there and talk about married life and raising a family and kids and so on and so forth. The bulletin boards are unique to each room and kind of address the subject of the room name. When you're in the room, you're in what we call a waiting room. You see tiles, you see little placards that have people's names on them. And those names, if you click on your right mouse button, you'll also be able to download their persona and see the picture that they've created for themselves, the hobbies that they claim they're interested in, their age if they've listed it, their town if they've listed it, and so on and so forth. You can then choose to just talk with that person, or you can invite them to play a game. And therein lies the beginning of a beautiful relationship.
You know, a lot of these games in Sierra Online were created by Ken's wife, Roberta. She's been on the show, and she was talking about her philosophy of games. So if she's a designer of these games, I guess it's not too amazing that women would like to play them as well.
Well, Roberta's designed some of the most, in fact, the most popular and best-selling games on the planet. Her game influence certainly carries over to the games on the Imagination Network, and when it was the Sierra Network as well. But there are no Roberta Williams games on the network per se. The types of games that Roberta does, by and large, don't really lend themselves to network play because there are multiple characters that have very defined possibilities as to what they can do and where they can go and so on and so forth. It's very hard to bring that kind of paradigm over to the paradigm of the network. We're working on it, and we'd like to be able to bring games like King's Quest and all of the other games that Roberta does over to the network, especially a mystery that she's now working on, which on CD is going to take up something like 100 megabytes. It's quite a game. But we haven't really been able to successfully figure a way to do it yet.
Now, I know with the regular adventure game, you play a little and you store it, and you play a little and you store it. You can't sit down for your 1,000 hours straight to conquer the most advanced game here. Is there a similar feature?
When you're in the Shadow of Cerberus or the Fates of Twinian and you're pursuing your goals, you accumulate certain treasures and those are stored, as well as build up your character. You build the strength of your character, you build the influences of your character, you build the gold that your character has, and so on and so forth. So that is stored on your disk.
Okay, so that other people are in the games with you at that time. Do they change as time goes on?
Everybody changes all the time. That's kind of the interesting part of the game. And if you play it once through with a team of people or by yourself, you never have the same experience twice if you play it again, which is kind of the beauty of the whole thing.
My guest today is Jeff Leibowitz, Director of Marketing for the Imagination Network and Chairman of the Special Interest Group for the Interactive Services Association. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. What's to keep a teenager from running up your bill?
We have a thing called billing level protection, and that is something that a parent can call and say to us, I don't want to spend more than X dollars, and we put that on the account, and if and when that limit is reached, we stop access to the account.
So it's actually, the telephone company should have something like that. They may.
That would be a great idea for the phone company, but it's kind of against their best interest to do so, other than from a PR view. We have a very interesting dynamic on the network, and that is, on the one hand, we are theoretically a for-profit business and have to run it as a business. On the other hand, we've done too good a job of creating a sense of community, to the point where our members sincerely feel that they are citizens in our electronic community and therefore have a vote, as they would in their town, as to what happens and who runs it and so on and so forth. And we take that responsibility as kind of town elders very seriously, and we do our best to balance the business aspect of what we do with the sort of cyber civic responsibility that we have as the town elders we're seen as by the members.
Now, in casino land, that's restricted to adults only.
Yes, it is.
Why is that?
We allow what we call, or what the industry calls, hot chat. And that is why we restrict it to children.
It's not just because they're gambling.
Well, of course, they're gambling with casino bucks. There's no value to the money. It's merely an issue of getting more than your neighbor or continuing to win. There are no graphics that are inherently adult. But there is hot chat, And we protect the kids from that by requiring a signature stating that you're over 21 for access. And it has its own unique password. So you may have one password to get into the network in general, and then you have another special password to get into Casinoland, which theoretically only the parents know.
And of course, we lie to them about why they need a password to get into Casinoland.
No, we don't lie to anybody. It's up to the parent.
I'm doing that. It's up to the parent.
Right.
That's right. How far away are your users?
We are strictly continental United States right now, and that is because of the access costs, which we feel are exorbitant in terms of either international or even Hawaii or Alaska access. There are a number of networks that are being developed now, specifically by our parent, AT&T, that are designed for the consumer market and will begin to address some of those issues. So costs should come down for play from Hawaii or Alaska. International tariffs are another situation where we don't have a whole lot of control over what Canada or England or Russia may charge for access to a telecommunications network. Right now, it's theoretically possible to access us from anywhere in the world, but it's inconceivably expensive.
Why is that?
The reasons are not really related to anything technical. They're related to tariffs or charges that other countries impose, kind of like a customs fee. If you're bringing product into and out of the country that is physical product, you pay some sort of tariff when you bring it into the country. Well, we don't have a physical product. We do, however, have an electronic product, and that comes over telecommunications lines. The only way they can tax or tariff our product is to simply tariff the time that we spend connected through to that country. And in the case of Russia, it's something on the order of $30 to $50 an hour. So it's extremely expensive.
Now, how much computer power do you need to service everybody who's on?
Believe it or not, the network runs on PCs. There are a series of currently almost 50 486-based PCs that are totally redundant and have power backup and all kinds of LAN backup. But the primary network that you are connected to and you as a user are online is simply a PC. We are going to move it over the coming months to Unix platforms, but that's really only an economic decision. It turns out that Unix machines now for this kind of usage are a little bit less expensive. But there's no need for super-duper power because the games actually run in your PC. They don't run on the network. All we do is know that you're playing against somebody else, and we trade packets of information between you so that you can play the game together.
Ah, so when I get my original package from you and I load it on my machine for access, then it's sitting there on my machine and I'm using it, and then all that's getting sent back and forth over the net are these little bitty pieces of information.
That's correct.
Very smart.
Well, that's why we do what we do.
There,
we
so
like
well.
It and we try to do it well.
Now, in a real tribute to technology, you don't have to have any of these things located all over the country. You're located in Oakhurst, California.
We are currently located in Oakhurst, California. Portions of the company are going to move up here to the Bay Area in the very near future, but the network itself, where the machines are, will continue to be located in Oakhurst for a long time.
Now, all you listeners out there who know where Oakhurst, California, may now raise their hand. How many people there? Where exactly is it? Both of them.
Oakhurst is the southern entrance to Yosemite National Park up in the Sierra. It's a beautiful area. It's basically a tourist town. We are the largest employer in the county, far and away, and certainly the only high technology company up there to speak of, though there are a few other small ones.
Now, Jeff, you're a New York boy. What's it
I
like
am.
Being in Oakhurst, California?
Well, do the words culture shock mean anything to you? The fact of the matter is that I travel a great deal, and frankly, I'm not in Oakhurst all that much. But it's a beautiful area. Not a whole lot of nightlife, not a whole lot of things to do, but a great school district and a wonderful place to raise a family. And it's basically a very nice area.
A terrific place to put a network.
Well, it doesn't really matter where you put a network, actually, because of the kind of ubiquitous nature of an online service and that we can be anywhere. When you make an 800 number call, do you really know or care where the call is going to? Not really.
Not really. And it really is an indicator how the infrastructure of the whole United States is changing. Things are moving. You didn't used to be able to do this.
And it will soon evolve to the whole world, where we will become one linked cyber community worldwide. It won't be too far off.
Jeff, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
My guest today has been Jeff Leibowitz. He's Director of Marketing for the Imagination Network. This network gives access to new forms of entertainment only possible through technology. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. And now, here's Barry Evans with a perspective entitled A Small Mystery.
Most reference books give the date for the invention of the telescope as 1608, and they usually attribute it to Dutchman Hans Lippershey. Less than 2 years later, an obscure professor of mathematics in Padua, Italy, published a book outlining the discoveries he had made by pointing a telescope at the night sky. The book was Sidereus Nuncius, the Starry Messenger, and its author was Galileo Galilei. Almost overnight, the science of astronomy was born. The mystery is this. Why was there a gap of over 300 years between the invention of the spectacles and the invention of the telescope? After all, a telescope in its very simplest form, as used by Galileo, is simply two spectacle lenses, one to correct near vision, the other to correct far vision, held a few inches apart. Try this for yourself. Put on a pair of far vision glasses and hold reading glasses a few inches in front of your face. Kazam! Instant telescope. We know that convex spectacles compensating for presbyopia, or farsightedness, were invented around the end of the 13th century. Presbyopia affects most people as they age, as cilia muscles of our eyes become too weak to allow us to focus on, for instance, closely held books. So the invention of spectacles for reading must have been an incredible boon back then, well, as it is today. In the first visual representation of glasses, a fresco dating to about 1350 on a church wall in Treviso, Italy, shows an aged cleric wearing spectacles as he copies a manuscript. 100 or so years later, around 1450, concave spectacles, to correct myopia or nearsightedness, were invented. So, why the long gap in time between glasses of both types and the telescope? Probably for two reasons. One, the poor quality of the glass used at the time, and two, the technical difficulties of making lenses of appropriate strength for telescopes. In fact, some historians of science believe that the telescope, in the form of two poorly constructed lenses which magnified at a distance, was known decades before 1608, but it was only then and in Holland that the technology allowed the creation of a useful instrument. As with all inventions, theory had to be accompanied by practical technology to turn an idea into a useful device.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.